from the later Neo-Assyrian period, which lasted from around 911 to 610 BCE, when the Assyrians built a truly vast empire. The Middle Assyrian kings managed to expand their kingdom all the way to the Euphrates River in the west. These kings tend to get overshadowed by their more famous descendants who built the Neo-Assyrian empire. But in a way, the Middle Assyrian kings were the ones who created the mold for later rulers to follow. The Middle Assyrian army had a large infantry and a smaller force of chariots. But the soldiers weren't available year-round. Most of them were Assyrian farmers, who were free to fight only about 3 months a year. This was during the summer between harvest and the sowing season. That changed in later centuries, when kings eventually created a standing army. But the army's organization stayed much the same over time, with divisions of 10, 50, and 100 men. Middle Assyrian military leaders also came up with the idea of deporting conquered peoples from one part of the empire to another. Although this was probably incredibly unpopular with the people being deported, it wasn't a death march. It wasn't really even designed as a punishment. The deportees were given shoes and provisions, and when they arrived at their destinations, they were also given land. The point was not to kill them. They were supposed to survive. Deportation was a way to settle people in underpopulated parts of the empire that could be opened up for farming. It was also a benefit, in the king's minds, to integrate the population so that the newly conquered peoples might begin to think of themselves as Assyrian. And of course, these peoples were less likely to rebel if they were busy making new lives for themselves far away from their original homelands. The Middle Assyrian kings, along with all their successors right to the end of the 7th century BCE, were considered to be high priests of the god Ashur. In most Mesopotamian lands, the priests and kings played distinct roles. But Assyrian kings were both. If an important festival came up, when a king was away on campaign, he had to return to perform in it. The kings were proud of the many temples they constructed for the gods in cities all over their empire. A lot of the royal inscriptions that survive are about these temples. So the Middle Assyrian kings were war leaders, priests, and builders of cities and temples. But in spite of their tendency towards self-promotion, the Assyrian kings didn't name the years of their reigns after their glorious successes, as southern Mesopotamian kings had done for centuries. Instead, each year was named for an official, called a limu, who was chosen by lot from the heads of powerful families, and who played a role in the annual New Year's festival. The man who held the post of limu during the year had the whole year named after him. You can imagine that these limu year names might have been hard to remember. Suppose you were born in the year called Enam Ashur, son of Begaya. How old would you be in the year Shuli, son of Uphakum? In our dating system, the year Enam Ashur probably corresponds to 1954 BCE, and the year Shuli was 1941 BCE. But at that time, they had no numbers for their years. Luckily, they did keep lists of limu names. This would let you figure out, in our example, that you were 13 years old in the year Shuli, son of Uphakum. Later scribes seem to have used these lists of limus from each reign to create a larger list of all the Assyrian kings and the lengths of their reigns. This documentation is useful for historians in reconstructing events and in understanding chronology. Chronology is a fascinating field of ancient history because it's a giant puzzle. Historians still aren't at all sure that we have the right dates for events before the first millennium BCE. Whenever I mention a date of an event or a king's reign, it means that modern scholars have reconstructed that date from several different types of evidence, and other scholars have certainly argued about it, and it may well still be wrong. Translating a limu date to a year BCE isn't a simple process. For example, 1400 BCE was 1400 years before Jesus was born. But of course, the people living at that time had no idea that they were in 1400 BC or BCE, because C hadn't been born yet. I did actually see on a message board once that a man claimed that the oldest coin he owned was 2,200 years old. He said it was stamped 225 BC. I hope he didn't pay much for it. Anyway, these Assyrian lists of Limmu names and lists of kings have helped historians count backwards from known dates so that they can assign BCE dates to historical events. From the 12th century BCE onwards, we can be pretty sure that the dates we use are correct for the main Mesopotamian kingdoms. Before that, there's a lot more uncertainty. Scholars have to look at things like ancient records of eclipses and of planets in the night sky. They look at tree rings and volcanic eruptions that left layers of ash in ice cores recovered from the Arctic Circle. And then they try to correlate those with kings and ancient events. It's a fascinating mystery. The longer ago the event, the more wrong the date we've come up with is likely to be. Some really early Limmu lists that have recently been found have been a huge help. It seems now that for events in the second millennium BCE, we're probably within a decade or so of being correct about most of the dates. So, let's go back to the end of the Middle Assyrian period. Between 1200 and 1100 BCE, the kingdom of Hatti collapsed, Egypt went into decline, and Assyria suffered too. Many lands that had been ruled by the Middle Assyrian kings gained their independence, and Assyria shrank back to its heartland. But the Assyrian people didn't forget about their glorious past. In the late 10th century BCE, an Assyrian king named Adad-nirari II came to the throne. Throughout his reign, he set about reconquering the lands in Syria that Assyria had lost control of more than 200 years before. Every summer, his troops went off on campaign to fight and raid and conquer. And if a land rebelled against him, then the troops would show up again and put down the rebellion. Earlier Mesopotamian kings fought only when they needed to. Adad-nirari II started the tradition of campaigning every single year. With Adad-nirari II, we come to the period when Assyria was its most powerful, the Neo-Assyrian period. It lasted for almost exactly 300 years. Adad-nirari's grandson was one of the most influential of all Assyrian kings. His name was Ashur-nazirpal II, and he ruled from 883 to 859 BCE. Ashur-nazirpal II made a very radical decision. He moved the capital city from Ashur up the Tigris to Kalhu, which is better known by its modern name of Nimrud. It had been occupied for centuries, but it had fallen into decay by this time. Still, it was where Ashur-nazirpal wanted to live and rule. He didn't move the temple of Ashur, of course. Its home in the city of Ashur was sacred. But the Assyrian government never returned to Ashur after the reign of Ashur-nazirpal II. Assyrian architects, builders, and sculptors worked for 15 years to transform Kalhu into the most impressive city anyone could imagine. A new city wall enclosed almost 900 acres. And this urban center had 9 new temples, along with a giant pyramid-shaped step tower called a ziggurat, and several palaces. In the center of the city, Ashur-nazirpal had his workers construct a new citadel. In an inscription, he claimed the foundations under it were very deep, 120 layers of brick. The city's crowning achievement was the King's Palace, which is known today as the Northwest Palace. It covered at least 7 acres, which is more than 5 American football fields. It might even have been larger, but the rest hasn't been excavated. The palace was built around 3 huge courtyards, and the king's throne room alone was 150 feet long and 35 feet wide, or 4,500 square feet. You could fit 3 medium-sized modern houses into just that throne room. The palace doors and gateways were guarded by giant stone sculptures of winged lions and winged bulls with human heads, like the ones that impressed me so much as a child at the British Museum. They weigh from 9 tons to as much as 36 tons, each one of them carved out of a single block of stone. They were there to protect the king and the palace. In a modern museum, when just one of these statues has to be moved, It often means closing the gallery for weeks or months. The Oriental Institute in Chicago needed to reinforce the floor in order to support the weight of one of these giant sculptures. Ashurnasirpal's palace had dozens of them. Mesopotamian royal palace walls had always been decorated. About 900 years before the time of Ashurnasirpal II, King Zimri-Lim of the Mari kingdom in Syria had brightly colored paintings on his palace walls. These must have been the norm in all eras, but they've mostly disintegrated, so we don't see them. Anyway, Ashurnasirpal came up with a plan for decorating the walls of his palace that surpassed all earlier attempts. In the public areas of the palace, all the brick walls were faced with giant stone panels made of a type of local gypsum. Each panel was as much as 14 feet in length and 8 feet high. Quarrying this stone and getting it into place would have been quite a feat. Many of the panels weigh a ton each. The panels were then decorated with elaborately detailed relief sculptures that were brightly painted. Unfortunately, the paint is long gone. Only tiny fragments of it survive. An artist must have designed all the panels and planned with the king and the priests exactly where each sculpted image would go. After the designs were sketched onto the stone, teams of expert sculptors carved the intricate images onto each block. If you get close, you can see more and more detail. Exact shapes embroidered on the clothing of every person depicted, the granulation of the jewelry, the shapes and tooling of every horse trapping. The paint on these sculptures would have made these details even more apparent. Some of the relief sculptures show the king being protected by the gods. He often has a winged genie standing behind him and a sacred tree in front of him, with a winged god hovering overhead. These weren't just for decoration. People believed that these sculptures possessed their own power and protected the king. The architects even consulted with priests to find out exactly where the protective gods should be placed. Other reliefs show life-sized images of people bringing tribute to the king. These lined the palace walls near where actual dignitaries would have walked, bringing their own gifts. And there are lots of scenes of the king hunting lions and of the king and his army fighting enemies. These progress like a graphic novel from one panel to the next. A visitor to the palace could follow what happened in a war by walking along beside the sculptures. The king wasn't depicted as being larger than everyone else. You can pick him out because of his headdress. It looks a little like an upside-down flower pot. He's shown right in the middle of battle, surrounded by the army in their many victorious campaigns. Across every stone panel, even the ones that didn't have relief sculptures, there's a cuneiform inscription. This is almost always the same one. It's known as Ashurnasirpal's standard inscription, and it proclaims the king's greatness and the support he had from the gods and the victories he achieved in battle. Of course, most people couldn't read, but the standard inscription probably wasn't designed just to be read by palace visitors. After all, why would they need to see it repeated over and over again? It was probably mostly for the gods and for the future. For centuries before this, Mesopotamian kings had stamped inscriptions on the bricks they used to construct their temples and palaces. Even though the inscriptions were covered by other bricks and weren't visible to viewers, every brick noted the king's name and the name of the building and the god it was dedicated to. No future king could falsely claim that the building was his work if every brick showed that he was lying. The stone reliefs in Ashurnasirpal's palace had the same effect. If the inscription was omnipresent, his deeds would never be forgotten, and no future king could take credit for his achievements. It worked. The stone panels ended up in at least 23 museums around the world, and every one of them proclaims Ashurnasirpal's greatness. When his palace was complete, Ashurnasirpal threw a huge party to celebrate. He invited almost 70,000 people from across the Assyrian Empire and from lands beyond the empire as well. His guests were given food, beer, and wine, and they were entertained for 10 days. No doubt, they were all completely wowed by the architecture and the sculpture of the new capital city, and by the power of the Assyrian king. Among the guests, 16,000 were citizens of Kalhu itself. These people had all moved there from around the empire. Meanwhile, the Assyrian empire had been expanding. The standard inscription, written all over the palace, describes how this was achieved. And the relief sculptures show details of tactics that the Assyrian military used for battles and sieges. The language Ashurnasirpal II used to describe himself was very different from that of some of the earlier Mesopotamian kings. He wasn't a kind shepherd to his subjects, like the 18th century BCE Babylonian king Hammurabi. He didn't try to make sure that weak people were protected from strong people, like the 22nd century BCE Sumerian king Orunama. Here's what Ashurnasirpal said about himself. He said he had no rival among the princes of the four quarters. He was fearless in battle, a king who subdues those insubordinate to him, he who rules all peoples, strong male who treads upon the necks of his foes, trampler of all enemies, he who smashes the forces of the rebellious. His successors followed this same model. They also described themselves as tramplers and smashers and subduers, and they increased the Assyrian military might. Soon, they had standing armies that were available to campaign year-round. They recruited men with military expertise from across the empire, so that normal Assyrian farmers weren't called up to serve anymore, though they still had to work on imperial building projects. In a way, the army became a reflection of the empire. The men spoke many different languages and carried many different local types of weapons and armor. Military divisions were stationed near the borders, ready to campaign at any time. Fighting techniques improved as well. For hundreds of years, the Assyrian army had consisted of foot soldiers and chariot soldiers. Now, the Assyrians added cavalry. The chariots got bigger and bigger, until four horses were needed to pull each one, and up to four men rode in each. After Ashurnasirpal, later Neo-Assyrian kings also decorated the walls of their palaces with relief sculptures of military campaigns, so we can see the technological advances. The reliefs often show attacks on cities. The warriors had battering rams that they could thrust against gates with protection for the men pushing them. They look like tanks. The Assyrian attackers set up siege towers. They tunneled under city walls or sapped the walls to weaken them. They rained arrows over the walls and threw flaming torches. But sieges were long and tough and expensive. So the generals often tried to negotiate with the people of a rebellious city. If diplomacy didn't work, the Assyrians would terrify citizens by impaling prisoners on stakes in public view. And if the local population still didn't give up and physical attacks didn't work, Assyrian soldiers were willing to spend months camped around a city until the people inside were starving and sick. So the Assyrian army was quite successful, but you can see how it wouldn't have been very popular. People in the provinces had to pay taxes and tribute. They had to fight for the Assyrian army, and they would have heard about the brutal ways the army treated rebels. In fact, the people who were subject to Assyria stood almost no chance of being able to rebel and gain their independence. The Israelites tried to break free of the empire, but their rebellions were put down repeatedly. Eventually, according to the Bible, most of the Israelites were deported to other parts of the Assyrian empire. The Judeans saw the Assyrians as harsh oppressors. In the book of Nahum, in the Hebrew Bible, the prophet wrote directly to the Assyrians. He said, "Who has not suffered your relentless cruelty?" This view was probably common among many of the conquered peoples. The whole idea of how to maintain an empire was now very different than it had been in earlier times. Kings like Hammurabi and Shamshi-Adad and Tushratta hadn't tried to terrify their subjects into submission. The Assyrians used terror frequently. On the other hand, the Assyrian army was no more brutal than the armies of some later empires, like the Romans. And this Neo-Assyrian period marks an important moment in world history because empires, truly vast and expansionist empires, became the norm for hundreds of years after this. Although Sargon of Akkad had created the world's first empire, 14 centuries before Ashurnasirpal II, the earlier empire hadn't lasted for long. Most of Mesopotamia's previous kingdoms had been city-states or territorial states, not empires. Experiments in empire building hadn't gone very well before. Also, ideas about democracy, human rights, and international law hadn't developed yet. Every state in the Near East at this time was ruled by a king. That had also been true of every state previously, even if past leaders hadn't all had the title of king. And kings ruled every state the Mesopotamians encountered. So it was obvious to them that a king was essential for running a state, just as it's obvious to us today that a CEO typically runs a large organization. In spite of the Assyrians' reputation for brutality, it was entirely possible for someone to live a happy life under Assyrian rule. Thousands of everyday documents from this era show that. The Assyrians developed a form of empire that was stable and successful, even though their tactics for ruling it shock us today. It must have seemed, after a century or so, as though the empire would go on forever.
Lecture 21, Ashurbanipal's Library and Gilgamesh.
One of the last great kings of the Neo-Assyrian Empire was Ashurbanipal, who ruled from 668 to around 630 BCE. If you were to judge him only from the relief sculptures on the walls of his palace, you'd see that he was a militaristic king who was preoccupied with battles and who filled his leisure hours by killing lions from a chariot. But he had another side as well. Unlike most Mesopotamian kings, Ashurbanipal was an intellectual, a man who could read and write, and who studied with the scholars at his court. He collected vast numbers of literary and religious works and organized them in a number of rooms in his palace at Nineveh, in the northern part of modern-day Iraq. This collection is considered to be one of the earliest libraries ever created. Since the documents were written on clay tablets, they survived for more than 2,500 years. When the library was rediscovered during the mid-19th century excavations, these same writings provided modern scholars with an extraordinary window into the intellectual world of the Neo-Assyrians. Ashurbanipal had included in his library a copy of a poem known as the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's considered to be a masterpiece of literature and the world's oldest epic poem. It was already more than 500 years old when Ashurbanipal's scribes wrote out the copy for his library. I'll come back to that in a moment. First, let's look at Ashurbanipal's library in more detail. Why was he so interested in the written word? It might have had something to do with his wife, Libali Sharat. We have a letter that was written to Libali Sharat before her husband became king. And though she might have found the letter annoying, it's fascinating for us. In it, her sister-in-law wrote, "Word of the king's daughter to Libali Sharat, why don't you write your tablet and do your homework?" Here, one princess was scolding another for not writing her tablets and not doing her homework. This implies that it was expected that the royal princess would be literate. Yet it's a surprise, because we don't have a lot of evidence for literate women in Mesopotamian history. The fact that Libali Sharat could read and write might suggest that she had some influence on her husband, or perhaps he had influence over her. Either way, they were a literate royal couple, a very unusual thing. After his father died, and Ashurbanipal became king in 668 BCE, he bragged about his wisdom. He wrote about all the types of study he had undertaken. "I learned the hidden secret, the whole of the scribal craft. I can discern celestial and terrestrial portents and deliberate in the assembly of the experts." He's saying that he could understand signs that were believed to come from the gods. He continued, "I am able to discuss the series, if the liver is a mirror image of the sky, with capable scholars. This was a scholarly text that listed liver omens and their interpretations, which he could analyze. Next, he said, I can solve convoluted reciprocals and calculations that do not come out evenly. So he was trained in complicated mathematics. And I have read cunningly written text in Sumerian, the interpretation of which is difficult. Sumerian was an ancient and dead language already by this time, but Ashurbanipal had studied and learned how to make sense of it. Finally, he said, I have examined stone inscriptions from before the flood, which are sealed, stopped up, mixed up. The documents he had read were so ancient that he believed that they had been written before the mythical flood. This would be like someone today being able to read medieval manuscripts. It would have taken a lot of time and effort to learn. All of this tells us that Ashurbanipal was deeply interested in scholarly learning. And as a result, he was singularly focused on the creation of his library. Now, it wasn't what we think of as a library. People couldn't come in and borrow cuneiform tablets to read and study. Instead, it was a collection of written works for the king's use and for his court. Yet it didn't include much of what you would expect in a library, like works about history or current events or scientific discoveries. Still, the shelves of Ashurbanipal's library were lined with tablets representing the most advanced knowledge of the time, knowledge useful to the king. There were tablets with long lists of words used by scribes in school, and there were copies of royal inscriptions from the past. There were rituals and hymns, some of them in the dead language of Sumerian. There were texts describing medical conditions and the ways to treat them. And there were thousands of omen texts, which listed a particular unusual event or sign and explained what was supposedly going to happen as a result of that sign. Only a few of the texts were what we would recognize as literary, stories about heroes and gods. The discovery of Ashurbanipal's library at Nineveh in the 1850s created front-page headlines once its contents began to be revealed. The two archaeologists who excavated there were Hormuz Rassam and Austin Henry Layard. Rassam was born in Iraq and educated at Oxford. He later became the British Museum's director of Mesopotamian excavations. And Layard was a British lawyer, archaeologist, and diplomat. Nineveh was of great interest in the new field of archaeology because it had been the fourth and largest capital of Assyria. The religious capital of Ashur was the first. Then Ashurnasirpal II had moved the capital to Kalhu. Later, a king named Sargon built a big new capital city that he modestly called Fort Sargon, after himself. Around 700 BCE, Sargon's son moved the capital, this time to Nineveh, which is where it stayed for the rest of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, until 612 BCE. The British excavator, Layard, described the discovery of the library this way. He wrote, to the height of a foot or more from the floor, the rooms were entirely filled with cuneiform documents, some entire, but the greater part broken into many fragments. Unfortunately, the archaeologists, Rassam and Layard, didn't really know what to do with so many cuneiform tablets. It was the first time that a really large collection of tablets had been uncovered, and the archaeologists didn't think to make notes of which ones were found in each location. So they put the tablets in boxes and shipped them back to the British Museum. In the process, the library tablets got mixed up with others that had been found in the palaces at Nineveh. Ever since, scholars have been trying to sort out the confusion, and it's very difficult. If the library had been excavated more recently, we'd have photographs of exactly where each fragment had been located when recovered, and we could see how the tablets had been originally organized. It does seem, though, that the library was spread across four different buildings on the citadel, two palaces and two temples. Once the tablets arrived in the British Museum, scholars set out to work on them, like a jigsaw puzzle, finding broken fragments that fit together and reconstructing the tablets. This continues. They also began to translate them. Cuneiform had only recently been deciphered, and there was a lot of interest in what was written on these tablets. There still is. One man who made a big contribution to this effort was a British Assyriologist named George Smith. He hadn't formally studied cuneiform or the Akkadian language. Actually, he didn't attend university at all. He was from a working-class family, and he left school young to become a banknote engraver. But he was a brilliant individual who was fascinated by cuneiform and taught himself how to read it. The British Museum brought him in to help work on the library tablets. In December 1872, about 20 years after Ashurbanipal's library was rediscovered, George Smith addressed the Society of Biblical Archaeology at the British Museum. He had astounding news. While working on mythological texts from Nineveh, he'd found 80 fragments from a single long poem written on 11 tablets. On tablet number 11, he discovered an account of a flood that was almost identical to the one in the Bible. A man was chosen by a god to survive a flood that wiped out almost all life. He was given instructions to build a boat and to load animals onto it. The floodwaters rose and the storm raged, but eventually the boat landed on a mountaintop. The man and his family survived, and they thanked the gods for their deliverance. This man's name was Utnapishtim, and the god who warned him about the flood was named Ea. But the similarities to the biblical story of Noah astounded everyone listening to Smith's talk. Newspapers around the world covered the story, and it was a great topic of conversation. Some people thought the Assyrian version confirmed the truth of the biblical tale. Others thought it raised more doubts. One London newspaper, The Telegraph, even decided to send Smith to Nineveh to search for more fragments of the flood story. Amazingly, he found them. I don't know of any other instance when an archaeologist wanted to find a particular piece of a text at a site and was able to do so. Think about it. 30,000 tablets and tablet fragments had been discovered at Nineveh during Layard's excavations, and only a handful of them came from the flood story. So the fact that Smith's later excavation recovered additional fragments of the flood tablet is almost unbelievable. But it's true. In Smith's book about this project, he notes that he started excavating at the palace on May 9th. And just 5 days later, his workmen uncovered what he was looking for. He wrote, "On cleaning one of the tablets, I found to my surprise and gratification that it contained the greater portion of 17 lines of the inscription, and fitting into the only place where there was a serious blank in the story. Now with this portion, I was enabled to make it nearly complete." Although the flood story got most of the press at the time, it was part of a remarkable poem that we call the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I mentioned earlier. The poem is very long. Modern translations cover at least 40 pages. It's also the best-known work of literature from Mesopotamia. We now have many more copies of it from other ancient sites. But it was first identified in the library at Nineveh. The author was a man named Sinleke Unini, who lived around 1200 BCE. Like the later Greek poet Homer, who was, of course, said to have written down the Iliad and the Odyssey, Sinleke Unini took legends that had been passed down orally, along with some earlier written versions of the epic, and he rewrote them and put them together into a literary masterpiece. His work was copied over and over again and ended up in Ashurbanipal's library some 500 years later. Gilgamesh probably was a real king who would have lived about 2,000 years before Ashurbanipal. I say probably because no evidence of him survives from his own time. But we know that some people mentioned with Gilgamesh in various tales were real, so he probably was too. The epic wasn't the only literary work to mention Gilgamesh, but already in older stories, he was something of a superhero. They said that he was victorious over not just human enemies, but monsters as well. He was thought to have had some divine blood. He even had conversations with gods, but he was still fundamentally seen as human. And to start with, his story had nothing to do with a flood. The Mesopotamians had told tales about a great flood, though, which they thought had happened tens of thousands of years in the past. The Mesopotamians' flood story was always similar to the one in the Bible, but in earlier versions, the hero of the tale didn't always have the same name. Sometimes he was Atrahasis. Sometimes he was Zeusudra. By the time the Epic of Gilgamesh was written, he was named Utnapishtim. Sinleke Unini took the Gilgamesh stories and the flood story, and he combined them into a single epic. His hero, Gilgamesh, was haunted by one of the great human dilemmas. He realized that he was going to die, and he didn't want to. Gilgamesh also had plenty of flaws. He was brash and arrogant, and the people he ruled, in the city of Uruk in southern Mesopotamia, were tired of him. At the beginning of the story, the citizens of Uruk ask the gods for relief from his demands, and the gods comply. They create a man who would be a match for the king. His name is Enkidu. Enkidu starts out like a wild creature, apparently convinced that he's one of the animals of the steppe. But he's tamed by a prostitute who convinces him that he is a man, and she brings him to Uruk. After fighting to a draw with Gilgamesh, Enkidu becomes the king's close friend, and they go off together on further adventures. The two companions imagine that they will make names for themselves and gain immortality, and they decide to do this by defeating a ferocious creature named Humbaba. Sinleke Unini wrote this speech for Gilgamesh. "I will conquer Humbaba in the forest of cedar. I will establish forever a name eternal." After a long battle, our heroes manage to defeat Humbaba. This makes the gods take notice. Gilgamesh even attracts the attentions of the goddess Ishtar, who was known for her passions. She was the goddess of both love and war. The poem continues. "On the beauty of Gilgamesh, Lady Ishtar looked with longing. Come, Gilgamesh, be you my bridegroom. Grant me your fruits, O grant me. Be you my husband and I your wife." But Gilgamesh wasn't interested. He knows all about Ishtar's reputation for mistreating men, and he wants nothing to do with her. He calls her a shoe that bites the foot of its owner, and a lot of other nasty things. Ishtar is furious about Gilgamesh's rejection. She asks her father, the god Anu, to send a creature called the Bull of Heaven to punish Gilgamesh. But again, Gilgamesh and Enkidu prevail. They are able to kill the Bull of Heaven. They cut out its heart and take it to the sun god. Now Ishtar is even madder than before. Hopping and stamping, she wailed in woe, "Alas, Gilgamesh, who mocked me, has killed the Bull of Heaven." The two heroes have become too self-confident. Now, Sinleke Unini changes the mood of his story and shows how Gilgamesh and Enkidu will be punished for their hubris. Enkidu wakes up one morning and tells Gilgamesh about a disturbing dream he's had. It was a vision of the afterlife, which he describes as dull and unpleasant. It was, he says, "the house which none who enters ever leaves, on the path that allows no journey back. People there had no light, they ate clay, and wore feathers like birds. Even former kings and priests were stuck there, with no special privileges." The Mesopotamians believed that dreams came from the gods, so clearly Enkidu has received a premonition of his own death. Sure enough, he grows weaker and sicker, and a few days later, he dies. Gilgamesh waits with the body for days, in disbelief, until a worm falls out of Enkidu's nose. Then he accepts that his friend is dead. Still, he mourns and wails for him. He walks around and around the body, and he tears out his hair and rips off his fine clothes. He's devastated. Enkidu is given an elaborate burial and lots of valuable grave goods. But something bigger is bothering Gilgamesh. If his dearest friend can die, then he faces the same fate. Tablet 9 of the epic finds Gilgamesh roaming around, disconsolate, and wondering what to do. He says, "I shall die, and shall I not be then as Enkidu? Sorrow has entered my heart. I am afraid of death, so I wander the wild." The gods aren't very reassuring. The sun god speaks to him directly, stating, "O Gilgamesh, where are you wandering? The life that you seek, you will never find." Still, Gilgamesh is undeterred. He has a plan. There's one mortal man he's heard of who has managed to live forever. If Gilgamesh can find this man, he will learn the secret of immortality. That man is Utnapishtim, the hero from the story of the flood. Eventually, A woman who's a tavern keeper and a man who ferries people on boats help Gilgamesh find the distant land where Utnapishtim lives with his wife. And here, at last, we come to Tablet 11 and the story of the flood. So although this had previously been a completely separate story, Sinleke Unini now brings it into the epic as part of Gilgamesh's search for eternal life. And it does make sense. Gilgamesh disappears from the narrative at this point, and Utnapishtim becomes the storyteller. The flood tale is told in his words, all about how he survived in his boat. At the end, and this is quite unlike the story of Noah, the god who'd caused the flood in the first place decides to give eternal life to Utnapishtim and his wife. So Gilgamesh has heard this whole story, but how is it supposed to help him? Another flood isn't about to happen. Gilgamesh can't duplicate Utnapishtim's experience. In fact, he can't even stay awake for more than a day. Utnapishtim tests him, and Gilgamesh fails. If he can't keep sleep away, how can he possibly defeat death? Gilgamesh is disconsolate. After all that searching, he has nothing to show for it. He says to the central character of this epic narrative, "Oh, Utnapishtim, what should I do and where should I go? A thief has taken hold of my flesh, for there in my bedchamber death does abide, and wherever I turn, there too will be death." Utnapishtim then presents Gilgamesh with an incredible gift, directions for finding a plant that will make him young again, the plant of heartbeat. Gilgamesh dives into the ocean to get the plant, and then he says to the boatman, "I will eat it myself and be again as I was in my youth." You can feel his excitement. All is not lost. He can put off death for ages now. But Gilgamesh is careless. Before eating the plant, he leaves it by a pond while bathing. It's stolen by a snake, which sheds its skin and becomes young, while Gilgamesh is condemned to die just as before. And now Sinleke Unini writes that Gilgamesh sat down and wept. This seems like a tragedy. The moral of the story seems to be that everyone will die. Even a hero who could kill divine monsters, even someone on speaking terms with the gods. But there is a note of optimism at the end. Gilgamesh says this to his boatman as they finally get home to Uruk. "Climb Uruk's wall and walk back and forth. Survey its foundations, examine the brickwork. Were its bricks not fired in an oven? Did the seven sages not lay its foundations? A square mile is city, a square mile is date grove, a square mile is clay pit, half a square mile the temple of Ishtar. 3 square miles and a half is Uruk's expanse." This might not seem like an obvious happy ending, but Gilgamesh is describing the city he rules, and apparently with pride. His city was founded by the gods, and it was a wonder to behold, 3.5 square miles in extent and made of baked bricks. In Gilgamesh's time, it was the largest and most modern city on the planet. In making this speech, Gilgamesh seems to have reconciled himself to his earthly and mortal existence as a king of an impressive kingdom. He can stop wandering the earth looking for immortality. There is so much in this epic tale that is really quite profound. And even hundreds of years before Sinleke Unini set down these words, the story of Gilgamesh was already a deeply thoughtful meditation on life and death. As seen in Enkidu's dream, the Mesopotamians didn't have any heaven to look forward to. The afterlife was dull and endless for everyone. In believing this, they were like most ancient peoples. But they still believed in their gods, because there was no other option. Religion didn't include a heavenly reward at that time. It was all about serving the gods and being rewarded in this life. So Gilgamesh's quest for immortality would have resonated with his audience. And the ultimate message was one of hope. In a version from the Old Babylonian period, at least 500 years earlier, the innkeeper gives a lovely speech that supplies one lesson of the tale. The innkeeper tells Gilgamesh, "The life that you seek, you will never find. When the gods created mankind, death they dispensed to mankind, life they kept for themselves. But you, Gilgamesh, Let your belly be full. Enjoy yourself always by day and by night. Make merry each day, dance and play day and night. Let your clothes be clean, let your head be washed, may you bathe in water. Gaze on the child who holds your hand. Let your wife enjoy your repeated embrace, for such is the destiny of mortal men. Of course, Gilgamesh ignores her advice and goes on searching for Utnapishtim, but this speech strikes me as instructive. The tavern keeper doesn't tell him to be kingly or to go and fight enemies. She tells him to enjoy his wife and child, eat well, and be merry. This advice would apply to anyone, not just to a king. It seems to have been a common Mesopotamian belief that you only live once, so seize the day and enjoy what you have, rather than trying to attain privileges that are reserved for the gods, like eternal life. Textbooks often tell us that the Mesopotamians were depressed, anxious, pessimistic people. And I don't buy it. For one thing, you can't stereotype a whole population like that, whether they're ancient or modern. And when you read the many different documents written in Mesopotamia, you see that, for the most part, they followed the innkeeper's advice to enjoy life. Perhaps their dismal view of the afterlife made them appreciate living all the more. The Epic of Gilgamesh has many other themes as well, like the importance of friendship and not upsetting the gods, and the idea that pride comes before a fall. This tale was very popular and was translated into other ancient languages. Fragments of it have been found at a number of sites across the Near East. King Ashurbanipal kept more than one copy of the Epic of Gilgamesh in his library, but most of the library texts were more practical. The majority of them were records of omens and divination. So when almost anything happened in the night sky, such as an eclipse of the moon or the appearance of a planet in a particular constellation, scholars consulted the omen texts to find out what this portended. By the time of Ashurbanipal, priests had kept accurate diaries of the movements of the planets and stars for about a century. They were even able to predict when eclipses would take place, though not where they would be observed, and where the planets would appear in the sky. But even then, the Mesopotamians believed that the gods were sending messages that way. If the king wanted an answer to a particular question, he could ask his diviners to practice extispicy. This was figuring out the will of the gods by reading the internal organs of sacrificed sheep and goats. The shape of the liver of the sacrificed animal was thought to be particularly useful. Each bump and depression and deformation of the liver was thought to have meaning that could be interpreted by the diviner. I've been told that in mammals, the liver has more variation than any other organ, so perhaps that made it a particularly good way to ascertain the messages that the gods wanted to send. The diviners of Mesopotamia couldn't just make things up. Their discoveries were believed to be predictable and scientific. They had to look up old reference books, well, reference tablets, to find out what had happened in the past when the same signs had been observed. Priests and officials often cited omens and oracles when they wrote to the king. It's quite possible that they consulted the royal library when they did so. Some tablets in the library had belonged to King Ashurbanipal's father and grandfather. Others were copied in Nineveh by scribes employed by Ashurbanipal himself. And some were copied from tablets seized in Babylonia, or they were written by Babylonian scribes who had been captured and forced to work in the king's library. Ashurbanipal also commissioned scribes in other cities to copy texts and send them to him. So the Assyrians were interested in big questions of human existence, and they systematically collected and organized knowledge and made accurate astronomical observations. Their endeavors moved people a step closer to what we now know as philosophy and science. As king, Ashurbanipal seems to have been determined to have access to as much written knowledge as he possibly could, even while he also tried to rule according to the wishes of the gods.
Lecture 22, Neo-Assyrian Empire, Warfare, and Collapse.
King Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria might originally have been a rebel, or he might have been someone who suppressed rebels who were trying to usurp the legitimate dynasty. Either way, he hadn't been directly in line for the throne, and he really benefited from a rebellion that broke out in the mid-8th century BCE. This chaotic time ultimately resulted in the legitimate king being deposed and Tiglath-Pileser III taking the throne. By this time, the Neo-Assyrian Empire was the biggest empire the world had ever known. It extended across Mesopotamia, Syria, and the Levant, and included parts of Anatolia as well. But the imperial structure was in some disarray. It had been set up more than a century earlier by one of Tiglath-Pileser's predecessors, King Ashurnasirpal II, and now it badly needed a reboot. Provincial governors had become quite independent, and rebellions had been occurring in many places. Once Tiglath-Pileser III took power, he instigated many changes, and the Assyrian administration finally mastered the running of an empire. The new king redrew the boundaries of provinces, making them smaller, and his governors, who were now less powerful, depended on him for their positions. The king also created a fast system of communication so that messages were passed between couriers riding on horseback. The messenger and his horse could rest after a day of riding, but the message continued on with a new carrier. So the message never had to pause. It was much like the later Pony Express in America. The king could be informed much more quickly this way about any problems that developed across the empire. Tiglath-Pileser III also expanded the empire into areas that had never been subject to Assyria before, and he forced these lands to pay tribute. The economies of these vassal states were streamlined so that resources were used efficiently. With these reforms during the mid-8th century BCE, the Assyrian Empire reached a period when it was at the height of its power. But only 135 years after Tiglath-Pileser III came to power, the empire fell. One of the foreign lands that Tiglath-Pileser took control of was Babylonia. The Assyrians worshipped Babylonian gods and respected Babylonia as an ancient civilization. Honestly, Assyria was a little bit in awe of Babylonia, and the Babylonians got special privileges under Assyrian rule. But one complication about being brought into the empire was that the Babylonians had a long tradition with regard to their king. Under this tradition, the legitimate king of Babylon had to take the hand of the god Marduk during a special ceremony during the New Year's festival. And that ceremony could only happen in Babylon. The king seems to have literally grasped the hand of the statue of the god Marduk. This gesture and the whole ceremony symbolized the king's devotion to the god and his devotion to Babylon. Tiglath-Pileser III actually did this, even though, like all Assyrian kings, he was personally devoted to the god Ashur. He took the hand of Marduk and ruled Babylon directly. But at other times, the Assyrian kings put their sons on the Babylonian throne, or appointed Babylonian kings who were loyal to Assyria. Sometimes this worked, but often it didn't. The Babylonians didn't like being ruled by Assyria. They had been a great power for such a long time, more than 1,000 years by the time of Tiglath-Pileser III, that they didn't think much of being subject to outsiders. But from the time that Tiglath-Pileser took over, the Babylonian throne changed hands 20 times in just 100 years. That's an average reign of just 5 years. Plus, the Babylonians had more than just the Assyrians to worry about. A group of people in the far south, called the Chaldeans, also often tried to take over Babylon. It was a mess, and things came to a head during the reign of a king named Sennacherib, ruled Assyria from 704 to 681 BCE. Although Sennacherib started out ruling Babylonia directly, he didn't take the hand of Marduk for some reason. So the Babylonians might never have really viewed him as legitimate. After 2 years, his rule in Babylonia was overthrown. A Babylonian took the hand of Marduk instead. But this man was quickly deposed by a usurper named Merodach-Baladan, who had wanted to rule Babylon for a long time and had the help of the neighboring Elamites. The Elamite kingdom was in the southwestern part of what is now Iran. Of course, Sennacherib was still king of the rest of the Assyrian Empire, and he viewed Merodach-Baladan as an evil villain. So he sent in his forces to bring the region back under Assyrian control. Merodach-Baladan fled, and this time Sennacherib put a puppet king on the throne, a Babylonian who was loyal to Assyria. But that didn't work either, and Sennacherib decided that he needed to have his own son on the throne in Babylonia. This might have seemed like a good idea, but it turned out to be a disaster. After a few years, the Elamites raided Babylonia, and they took Sennacherib's son away. We don't know what happened to him. Presumably it wasn't good. The Babylonians once again appointed a local king, and once again Sennacherib's army showed up to remove him. You can imagine that the Babylonians were getting angrier and angrier with the Assyrians. So again, the Babylonians chose a local king, and this time they formed an alliance with several neighboring kingdoms, including their former enemies, the Chaldeans and the Elamites, to attack the Assyrian army. They fought a vicious, bloody battle, but neither side clearly won the day. Sennacherib must have been furious. His son was gone, and the Babylonians had repeatedly rejected Assyrian rule. So, in 690 BCE, he took a huge army and he attacked the capital city of Babylon. When the Babylonians didn't give up, the Assyrians set up a siege around the city. These two great powers, they were like twins in a way. Their peoples spoke the same language. They worshipped the same gods. They had much the same culture and history. Babylonia was the older society, Assyria the younger one. But you'd think they would have been natural allies, and now they were enemies. In 689, Sennacherib's forces entered Babylon. They didn't hold back. According to Sennacherib's annals, the Assyrians sacked with a vengeance. They destroyed temples, houses, and palaces, and they redirected the river so that water swamped parts of the city. They even took the statue of the god Marduk away from Babylon. This, of course, wasn't just seen as a statue. It was the god himself. The Babylonians saw the Assyrians' attack on the temples as blasphemy. Even some Assyrians would have been worried. After all, they worshipped Babylonian gods too. Soon after this, the Assyrians began rebuilding the city of Babylon. But the relationship between the two kingdoms was damaged, and the Elamites were now aligned against Assyria as well. Sennacherib had led fierce campaigns into their land too, so the Assyrians were gaining some pretty powerful enemies. Sennacherib had achieved other things in his reign too, of course, besides subduing Babylon. He'd moved the capital to the ancient city of Nineveh, near the modern city of Mosul, and he'd sponsored a massive building program there, doubling the size of the city. Nineveh was absolutely enormous for an ancient city. It covered about 1,750 acres, and its population might have been as much as 230,000. To give you a sense of scale, it was about 15 times the size of Jerusalem at the same time, and had about 23 times as many people living there. The new capital needed a regular water supply for its vast population and for its many orchards and gardens. So Sennacherib oversaw the construction of a 60-mile-long canal that brought water from the mountains. At one point, the canal had to pass across a valley. So the Assyrian engineers created a stone aqueduct 30 feet high. The inscription on the aqueduct says, in Sennacherib's words, "Over deep-cut ravines, I spanned a bridge of white stone blocks. I caused those waters to flow over it." Sennacherib's new palace in Nineveh was bigger and more impressive than the palaces that had come before. Like his predecessor, Ashurnazirpal II, from the 9th century BCE, Sennacherib commissioned stone relief sculptures for the walls of the palace that showed his great military victories over his